to the internet and they can't hear you.
April 15, 2012, questions answered in Soho, London.
So this is just an open, it can be about the class or it can be about anything you want. I might not answer anything you want.
Hare Krishna.
Lovely to see you.
Oh, lovely to see you too. How many is there?
Just one general question.
Yes.
The question of the nectar of devotion. Can you say anything about it?
Well, I can say a lot. Do you have a specific question?
The levels of Bhava. B-H-A-B-A. Bhava, yes.
What do you mean by levels of
Bhava? In terms of action, what you gauge it on your, you might say, spiritual progress, and also symptoms of devotion. Can you say anything about that?
So the symptoms, here I can remember all the 9 symptoms of Bhava. Maybe some of you can help me. Symptoms of Bhava: humility, a concern that time will not be wasted, attachment to chanting the holy name, attachment to living in the holy place, attachment to being with devotees. It's another 4. I don't remember the other 4. And there's not usually kinds of Bhava listed, although you could say that there's an attraction for Krishna in Vrindavan and an attraction for Krishna in Dwarka and Mathura. And you could also say a Bhava that in any of those places, there's an attraction in conjugal love and there's attraction in the other Vaibhavs. So it is divided like that.
Thank you.
Somebody else?
Ask a question. Hare Krishna
Maharaj. My
friend said that in another discussion you were telling about especially managing time where householder, you work and you have your household deities, your deity work and everything, about managing time, how would you, and giving the equal energy for everyone throughout.
How do you manage your time when you have a lot to do?
When your energy is distributed among various responsibilities throughout the day, and how to keep up the energy level throughout.
Okay. So everybody has a certain amount of energy that you start with every day. Some of us more than others. Most people, when they're young, have more energy than they need for the day. As you get older, that changes. You get to a point where you have less energy than what you want to do for the day. And then you basically have to gauge about how much energy you have and what you need to get done or what you want to get done. And you apportion your energy appropriately. By the way, it's not time, it's energy. Not time, it's energy. If you've used up all your energy by 4 o'clock, it doesn't matter that you still got some more hours in the day. You're useless. You've all experienced that? That you've used up your quota of energy for the day by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and you can't do anything useful. So you set aside, mentally, think of it like a pie or a cake, you know, those different pieces, and you just, okay, I'm going to give this amount of energy to my cooking, I'm going to give this amount of energy to my job, I'm going to give this amount of energy to my children, to my husband, I'm going to give this amount of energy to my chanting and my reading. And then whatever you're doing, you give your attention to that. But you don't give all your energy to that. You give just the amount of energy that you allot it, and you keep reserve for the rest of what you're going to do. It works very well.
Sometimes we get to overdo it.
Well, there are always, occasionally there are emergencies. But if you have a life where you're having an emergency more than 3 or 4 times a year, you probably need to make some changes in your life. So there are occasionally emergencies where all of a sudden you have to give a lot more energy to something in particular than you had allocated. The same happens with money. You know, you can budget your money, but there may be an emergency. But if that's happening regularly, you understand? Then you need to go back and see, well, what am I doing?
Hare Krishna, you mentioned Trinidad. Did you actually go to Trinidad yourself?
I sure did.
Is that Trinidad and Tobago? Tell me, what was your impression of the place? Obviously,
it's hot.
As well.
And humid.
Yeah. Could you say any more?
It was really hot. It was really humid. It was an interesting place. You know, I'm accustomed to the idea that there's 40 kinds of apples. I didn't know there were 40 kinds of mangoes. It was very fascinating that they gave me a red delicious apple as if it was something very precious, like they were giving me, you know, a diamond ring. Whereas for me, the red delicious apple was nothing. And it was just interesting how we tend to see things according to our own conditioning. That they were literally letting mangoes rot on the side of the road and paying $5 for one apple. I mean, it was all packaged. And it was also interesting that how many people there wanted to go to New York and how many people in New York wanted to go there. That was also interesting. What else did I find interesting? That most of the devotees there had a little garden and they would bring the produce from their garden to the temple so that the vast majority of what was being cooked there was locally grown, organic, fresh picked. And I asked them, I said, what's the juice here at the Sunday feast? Oh, that's fresh passion fruit juice. And I said, wow, you know, where I'm from in America, you buy a little bottle for $2. And everybody got, you know, a big cup of passion fruit juice. Again, there was so much abundance that that fruits and vegetables were rotting because people couldn't even use all of it. So that was also really interesting. Another really interesting thing is that at least when I was there, which was quite a while ago, the island is half black, half Indian, both of whom were brought there either as slaves or as cheap labor. And there's, I think, only 0.6% of the population is other than black or Indian. And the Indians all thought they were better than the blacks, and the blacks all thought they were better than the Indians. So that was also interesting. Each group looked down on the other as an inferior race. Another really fascinating experience. I had lovely ISKCON devotees there. So I was there for Krishna's birthday for Janmashtami. Are you all interested in this?
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Like National Geographic.
Because it's festival.
Oh, okay. So the Indians there are mostly Hindus. I don't think there's very many Muslims there. So some of them were celebrating Janmashtami on a different day, and they asked me if I'd like to go to a local Hindu Janmashtami program where I could give class. I said, sure, why not? So we go there, and it was a mixture of Hinduism and like voodoo. It was one of the strangest things that I've ever seen. So they had this big deity of Shiva and another one of Durga, and then they had one of Krishna, but Krishna didn't look very nice. It was like baby Krishna, but he looked kind of like kind of weird. And then there was this strange dance going on, which I didn't want to imitate, but it was really odd. And there was this woman doing this weird dance, and these other guys were doing this kind of dance, and she would go up to them, you know, and she'd put her thumb on their forehead, and then their eyes would roll into their head and they would faint on the ground. And the devotees who brought me there kept saying, oh, we're so sorry. I said, it's great. It's like watching a National Geographic documentary. I said, I also need to tell my students when I get back to America. So I thought it was fascinating. Prabhupada talks about that kind of thing in his purports. This idea that the guru gives you some sort of an electric shock, and then you faint, and the guru faints and says, I've exhausted all my powers. And so Prabhupada must have seen that same kind of thing also in India. This pseudo-magical, superstitious, so-called spirituality. So I got to see it firsthand. It was definitely interesting. But I also spoke there. That was just lovely, lovely devotees. Just recently when I was in Mayapur, I saw one of the temple presidents from there. I think it's one of the few places where we have, I don't know if I should say that, I'll get in trouble. That's one of the few places where we have an openly polygamous family.
Was that Mayapur?
No, in Trinidad. There was one police officer who was secretly keeping two wives and with their kids in different places. They didn't know about each other. But when he got interested in Krishna consciousness, both of his wives with their children got interested also, and they ended up meeting each other. So they said, well, you know, I guess we'll just go on like that. So now it's just open. Just openly there with two wives. So that was also interesting. I haven't run into that very many places.
You know, in the transcendental world, the only one allowed to do that is Krishna.
That's not true.
That's
not true.
No.
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 Not at all. Even Draupadi has five husbands in the transcendental world. Mm-hmm. And Arjuna is married to Draupadi and Subhadra. Yes.
You talked about meditation, well, actually, all these weird movements and things. When people in Padfield, in this yoga, meditate, do they ever experience any of these physical kriyas? Have you heard the phrase kriyas?
Yeah. There is 8 specific sattvic bhavs that are experienced by devotees as they advance in Krishna consciousness. Sometimes they're even experienced on a lower level, as a shadow or reflection of the actual bhava, and that includes things like trembling and crying and perspiration and turning pale. And
so it is normal then in a field as well?
Definitely.
CC.
In fact, we just read that verse this morning, one of the many that talk about such things. Although generally, a person experiencing such things makes an effort publicly to hide them if they can. It's because those are involuntary things. They're involuntary expressions of love. There's voluntary expressions of love, those are called anubhava. And the involuntary expressions of love are called sattvic bhavas. But one doesn't generally, even materially, maybe nowadays people do, I don't know, but at least in civilized societies, people didn't display their intimate love publicly. Nowadays, maybe that's so. Also, love for God, because the problem is that people can fake that kind of thing and display it for some sort of reputation or adoration. But sometimes, even with the devotee making an effort to control it, sometimes it's displayed in them. Sometimes the spiritual emotions are so strong.
The other thing that I find quite interesting is how much dancing.
Would you use the microphone? I think I'm not quite sure why, but we're asked to use the microphone.
I've got quite a lot.
Is it being recorded? Okay, so.
The other thing I find quite intriguing in Bhakti Yoga here is that, you know, there is so much active dancing and jumping and joy. And that is all sort of very sort of, everybody does it in a particular style. Do you have classes for this or
no? Maybe we should have.
But it's very beautiful to watch.
I think actually some places there are sometimes devotees do public programs where people are dancing and singing on stage, and then sometimes they will actually have some sort of choreography direction. Of course, we do also have very developed dance forms. like Bharatanatyam and Kathak, and where then people do get specific instructions, and those are, but those are done a little different. Similar, but a little different.
Who else has got a question?
Hare Krishna. Is Krishna the only spiritual science of the self? Is Krishna?
Krishna is a person, he's not a spiritual science. Do you mean Krishna consciousness?
Is Krishna the only spiritual science of the self?
I'm not exactly sure what you're asking. What do you mean by Krishna? Do you mean the International Society for Krishna Consciousness? Do you mean is the International Society for Krishna Consciousness the only organization that teaches the science of itself? No, of course not.
Yeah?
No. Is that what you mean? I'm not sure what you mean.
Krishna himself.
Krishna is a person. He's not a scientist.
Yeah.
He's a person.
Is he whom I'm talking about?
Okay.
Is he the only spiritual science of the self?
He's not a science at all. He's a person.
Is he the only one who knows the self science?
Oh, no, no. Many. Krishna's God.
He is.
But there may be saintly persons who also know the science of the self.
But who is highest then?
Who is the highest one?
In the self science. Who comes highest? Him.
He's God, yes. So God means the
highest. So he comes highest.
Well, God means the highest. Yeah. If he's not the highest, he's not God. He's something else.
Okay, I think I have the answer. Okay. I put him the highest in the self-science. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Sure.
Krishna, I really enjoyed your lecture, and you said something interesting about that actually all the energies, even the material energies, are actually, if looking from a different perspective, I guess, and a higher perspective, they're all spiritual.
Yeah.
So, I'm not anywhere close to that. But what does that mean if you look at like world events or people in political positions or something? When if they make decisions that affect our lives, or when world events happen, like wars or something. And at a certain level, it's also spiritual, because it's something...
Okay, but you can't mix levels of consciousness.
Okay. Well, can you explain a little bit about how you look at that?
I don't know if that's something you can explain.
Okay.
You're talking about levels of consciousness.
Yeah.
So you're kind of, looking up and saying, how does that look like looking down?
Mm-hmm.
So from a higher level of consciousness, everything is happening according to the desire of living beings, and everybody is experiencing their own desires through their own karma. And all of that is being done by persons. All of the different energies that we're dealing with are all personal, and all energies of desire, and everybody's experiencing exactly what they want to experience. Srila Prabhupada talks about how there's, of the 12 rasas, the 5 primary and the 7 secondary, that anything that happens is really just trying to experience those tastes, those flavors. Rasa means a taste or a flavor, or means liquid. So we can either try to experience them in relationship with Krishna, or in an illusion of being separate from Krishna. But that's all that's going on. So when you see that all there is a spiritual energy, people either using it properly or not using it properly. People who aren't using it properly are experiencing it as material and suffering. People who are using it properly are experiencing it properly and they're happy.
The person who is, let's say, advanced in spiritual consciousness, whatever he experiences is not material anymore.
No.
So that even if there was a certain level, he lives in a certain country, and
he's not really experiencing that he's living in a certain country in that way.
Right.
Yes and no.
Yeah, but okay. Let's just ask the specific question. If he experiences something, you know, bad, negative, you were talking about the three different ways of bad things happening, either from yourself or your body or from other living entities of nature. But if a person is spiritually advanced enough, then these negative events have some kind of spiritual meaning or not.
Correct. So on that level, you don't really see anything as bad. Krishna Das Kaviraj says this. He said, this concept, this is good, this is bad. It's not like that. You know, on a material level, people may say, well, the reason it's actually good that I got fired is that I got another job. In other words, they're saying that the bad material things are actually good because they lead to some good material things, which sometimes is the case, but it's not always the case. I mean, I've had, you know, negative things happen to me that ended up being a positive thing from a material perspective. But that's not what we mean. We mean that everything, whether even if it stays bad on a material perspective, that one sees everything as good. You can't imitate that perspective. You can't imitate that consciousness. You can't just go around saying, I see it. So it doesn't make sense from a lower level of consciousness. We can at least just say, in theory, we can understand that somebody at that level of consciousness sees things radically differently and experiences things radically differently. I mean, even the difference between, like, there's some children here. So how old are these guys?
Six.
You guys are identical twins?
Yeah.
So when you're six, what's good and what's bad looks different than when you're 26. You know, if you're around little children, so little, like, do you guys ever fight? No? So, you know, if one of your sons starts taking this toy and starts hitting his brother with it, so the mother will take the toy away. So the child who's hitting, that's bad. Mommy took my toy away. Maybe mommy puts you in the corner and says, go stand in the corner until you learn how to play with your brother. So from the point of view of the child, that's bad. My mommy did something bad happened to me. My toy got taken away and I'm standing in the corner. But it's not bad, it's good. Now the mother is thinking, I want my child to grow up to be a civilized human being. Why? For the good of the child. And for the good of society, that the parents have an obligation to make sure that the child knows how to behave so that they're be happy, and also so they don't go around hitting other people with toys when they grow up. So those actions are good, but the child doesn't necessarily see them as good. You know, I'm waiting to meet the child who, when the parent does that, says, oh, thank you, Mommy. That's not what they do. I want to get out of the corner. Give me my fire truck back. And they may even say, I hate you, Mommy. They do. And it's very difficult. I haven't had much success with this. But to go to a six-year-old child and say, now really I'm doing this because it's good for you. It doesn't seem to work. They don't get it. I mean, even we had an experience with my granddaughter when she was, how old was she then? Maybe eight. And she had an infection in one of her teeth. So the dentist, you know, worked on it, and then he said she's got to rinse her mouth out regularly with this stuff so that to keep it, you know, to heal the infection. And it was not nice tasting stuff. So she didn't want to do it. And it was a whole scene. She's kind of a little princessy sort of kid. And if you hear this, sorry, I love you. So she was, you know, she didn't want to do it, and my son was trying to reason with her. He's that kind of a person. He's one of these logical, analytical, reasonable type people. And so he was spending hours you know, Satara, you have this infection, let's look at the, this what Denda said, and let's look in the mirror, and this is when we kill all the little bugs in your mouth, and it just didn't work. And after that whole thing, like, you don't like me! If you liked me, you wouldn't make me do this. And eventually we had to actually force her. You know, we could not get her willing cooperation. So from her perspective, it was bad. And there was, we were not able, we tried, we were not able to get her to see things from our perspective. She was stuck. We just couldn't. We tried. So in the same way, things that happen to us, we don't really understand them. And we can hear from the scriptures, we can hear from the saintly persons, and sometimes we can get it, other times we just don't get it. But it's bad. But it's material, but it's bad. And we have to come to a level of spiritual maturity until we can understand it. And as, I mean, one of the ways you can tell you're advancing in spiritual life is that you will understand things more and more. Your perspective will change. Just like how you know you're becoming an adult, because your perspective changes, right? We all remember that happening when we're like 12, 13, 14. All of a sudden, like, oh, that's what they were telling me all these years. That's what is happening here. So in a similar way, as you advance in devotion, you'll say, oh, now this thing I read in the scriptures, this thing I was told, now it makes sense to me. Now I can actually experience it. Now I can actually see it.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Sure.
Yeah. Prabhu, I have a different type of problem.
Okay.
I am obsessed with studies all the time. I'm quite happy with the book for 8 hours. But when it comes to household work, I shirk it like anything, and I don't bring it to practice. Can you motivate me somehow?
Maybe you can hire somebody? Do you have enough money to hire somebody? Seriously, can you hire somebody to do it?
Well, I'm not that rich. But it's a serious problem, a real serious problem. I'm quite happy with my books for 8 hours, 10 hours.
Well, what consequences do you have when you don't do anything in the house?
When I don't, sorry, say it again.
What consequences do you have?
Well, that's the trouble. You see, I'm getting into a mess, big mess.
Like what kind of mess? What's the problem?
Well, clutter all around, books buried in books. Things like that, yeah.
Let's get the kids.
Does it bother you?
Sorry?
Does it bother you?
Well, it doesn't bother me, but I know sooner or later it's going to catch up with me.
Well, if it doesn't bother you, then maybe you don't need to do anything then.
What about cleanliness?
No, does it bother you? Obviously it doesn't bother you enough to do anything about it.
Well, it doesn't really bother me in that sense. Okay. Things are getting out of control. Like I feel shy inviting somebody in.
If you're just going to read all day, what does it matter?
give me some practical help, yeah.
But I don't think you want any. It doesn't bother you that they're all over the place and you don't even want guests over because you're happy reading. If it actually bothered you, you do something about it. You know that, right?
It bothers me, but still.
It doesn't bother you very much.
But not really.
Not really. I mean, one of the things that I found just on a practical level is to be really honest with ourselves. To be really, really honest with ourselves. What do I really care about? And instead of beating ourselves up because we don't care about everything, because nobody can care about everything, be honest. What do I care about? I mean, the biggest problem with having books all over the place is when you die, someone else is going to have to go through your house and sort through them. Now, that's one of my motives for keeping things neat, honestly. Because I've been with people where their relatives died and their poor children or grandchildren sometimes had to spend 1 year going through all the stuff they accumulated. So after seeing some of my friends have to do that for their relatives, I thought I really should make sure that I don't keep a lot of clutter. Because even if I don't care about all the clutter, somebody else is going to have to deal with it someday. Now that helps me. Also, I personally like to live in an uncluttered environment. But I've spent, for me, I can't think. That's just me. Doesn't mean that that's good, okay? It's just me. I personally can't think if there's a lot of clutter around, because it just drives me nuts. And I can't function much if things are very dirty or cluttered. So I'd rather the austerity of picking things up and taking the time to do that than to be in a disorganized environment. But I've met a lot of people who are the opposite. They can think just fine in a cluttered environment. They don't have any problem at all. I've been to people's houses where they don't have a filing system, they have a piling system. But and I'll say, how can you work? You know, they go to their desk and they're using their computer and there's no room to, it's no room to move the mouse. And there's, how do you think? But they do it. And they're successful in their work and they're doing fine. So to those people, you know, to them, they have a different environment that they're comfortable in. So be honest. What are you comfortable with? What are you willing to do? What kind of austerity are you willing to do? No, for me, I'd rather the austerity of cleaning up and picking up rather than the austerity of being in a dirty and cluttered place. Some people would rather the austerity of a dirty and cluttered place than the austerity of cleaning up. And look honestly at what your priorities are. Many times we're guilty and we just feel bad. We don't do anything about it. You know what I'm saying? We have some things in our life that all we ever do is feel guilty about them. Isn't that stupid? I was told never to be stupid in London. Isn't that foolish? Isn't that silly? I was told to be silly. Don't say stupid in the UK. Say silly. So isn't that silly? You know, I have these things that I don't do or I do, and I don't change them, I don't fix them, I don't do anything about them. All I do is feel bad about them. That's absurd. Silly. So either accept what you are and live with it, or change. But don't just go around feeling guilty. What is the point of that? I don't see what the point of that is. What a waste of human energy. So either decide this is something actually important to me and I'm really going to take an hour every week and do it, or say it actually isn't important to me. I really don't care. It's not my priority. I'm happy the way I am. I can live with myself the way I am. I'm not causing any great pain to anybody else, and that's just what I'm going to do. Now, if you're happy but you're causing pain to somebody else, then you may decide to make a change for somebody else. But I see no profit in just spending, you know, weeks or months or years of your life feeling bad about something that you're not willing to change. We only have so much physical and mental energy, and you're pouring energy into just bad feeling. You know what happens when you feel bad about something like that all the time? You're less likely to do it. Did you know that? Because you associate that thing with feeling bad. So you notice, I'm messy, I don't clean, I'm messy. So every time you think about cleaning, you associate it with all these bad feelings. And then you really don't want to do it. Another thing you can do is whenever you do a little bit of cleaning or a little bit of organizing, tell yourself how nice it is. Instead of saying, well, I only did a little bit. I was dealing with one lady who was having difficulty chanting 16 rounds, although she was initiated. And she was telling me that she wasn't finishing her rounds and all she was ever doing was feeling guilty about it. She said, every day I just don't finish my rounds. Every day I feel bad. I said, what you're doing is you're emotionally associating chanting your rounds with feeling guilty. Then you're even less likely to chant. I said, why don't you celebrate how many rounds you do chant? I said, like today, how many rounds? We were actually in this room several years ago. I was talking to her in this room. I said, how many rounds did you chant today? And she said something really funny. She said, I have 4 left. I don't know if she ever understood the point I was trying to make. But if all you do is, you know, do 5 minutes of cleaning, then say to yourself, hey, I did 5 minutes of cleaning. Great. That will also help. Guilt is very useful for a few minutes. It's a very useful thing for a few minutes to get us to move. It's not a useful thing to swim in. It just isn't. It doesn't. It associates, it actually keeps us from doing the things we want. It associates, this is all psychology, this is spirituality. It associates negative emotions with the things that we want to do. And it's sapping our energy. So my first suggestion is decide what your real priorities are. Decide what kind of person you are. Decide the way you really want to live, and then be satisfied with that. I haven't met a living being, a soul, a jiva, who's perfect in everything. I just haven't met such a person. I haven't read about such a person in the Shastra. I don't think they exist. Only God is perfect in everything. Just isn't the way it is. So some things I'm good at, some things I'm not good at. Now, if there's something I'm not good at and it needs to be done, then I have to ask somebody else to do it. So, you know, if you're really bad at cleaning and you hate it and the cleaning has to be done, then go earn a little bit more money and hire somebody. If there's something I have to do and I'm bad at it, I have to get somebody else to do it. And then if there's things that you really want to change in yourself, it's much better to do it with rewards instead of punishment. We function much better that way. Reward yourself for whatever you do that's good instead of beating yourself up for what you do that's bad. And you can beat yourself up a little bit sometimes, but don't be beating yourself up all the time. It will have the opposite result. Okay?
Yeah, could you kind of give me some thoughts on how to bring things to practice? Just your thoughts.
Things to practice.
Practice,
too
yeah.
Vague. Be a little bit more specific. Or a lot more specific.
I mean,
what things?
You know, things in sense. I'm talking of spiritual things. And the books I'm talking about.
Okay, so how to actually practice what you read?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, what's really nice about bhakti yoga is if you're reading, that is bhakti.
Yeah,
isn't that nice? So if you're reading Bhagavatam, you're practicing Bhagavatam just by reading Bhagavatam. You can become spiritually perfect just by reading Bhagavatam.
Well, which I do.
There you go.
Not necessarily Bhagavatam, but I read all the time spiritual books, nothing else.
Okay, well, if you're actually reading spiritual books about bhakti yoga, then the reading themselves, that's shravanam. That shravanam is bhakti. And Krishna says, one who studies this sacred conversation worships me by his intelligence. Maharaj Brigad attained perfection by hearing. So then you can say, how can I read about Krishna in such a way that my reading is bhakti? Then you have to read with rapt attention. And Prabhupada says, to read with rapt attention, you have to be pure in action. He said, to be pure in action, you have to be pure in eating, sleeping, fearing, and defending. And to be pure in action, one has to be pure in mind. So we want to read with a mood of devotion and with a mood of purity and have a life of purity. And then as you do that, then your reading is practice.
Well, that is actually...
As far as putting other things into practice, that's mostly association. Being with other people who are doing those things. Maybe getting together with other people who are doing those things. Having a time. We'll get together every Thursday at 6 o'clock and... We'll have kirtan together and things like that. And having some association.
Thank you. But
that was a very general question, so it's hard for me to give a very specific. Somebody else?
Hi, Krishna.
Hi, Krishna.
Srila Prabhupada explains just something inside. We have to come to the level of pure goodness. From goodness, we have to go to pure goodness, and so that we can really get to the real thing. Sometimes, when I'm reading scriptures, maybe Srimad Bhagavatam, different scriptures in general, they will make a point like, by, I don't know, reading these or doing that, you will get certain benefits, and that benefit, and this, and that. And some, I tend to think when I'm reading that, it feels like it's more stimulating, the more passion in me.
Interesting.
Instead of, to see my point, I wonder if you can elaborate on that.
So the scriptures, the Krishna and the sages who compiled the scriptures, there's several answers. First of all, that they understood that people reading them were not necessarily coming with the highest motives. So yes, they were also using other inducements. That yes, you can get this benefit and that benefit. That's definitely there. And that's also factual. Because frankly, if you go to people and say, like I used to do in the Chicago airport, I used to go up to people with our Bhakti Godhead magazine and say, here, take this book about love of God. You know, it's not... Most people don't wake up in the morning and say, when am I going to get a book about love of God? I mean, if we're going to be really honest, even all of our members of the Hare Krishna movement don't wake up thinking like that. Let's just speak of the people on the street. So, you know, when we're distributing books, we'll often say things like, oh, this will help you understand yourself. Like, we drew a big crowd in Croatia. How to like yourself. So that's, which is also certainly in the scriptures. Krishna talks about how to like yourself. So there is some inducement like that. But also a lot of those benedictions can be understood also on a higher level. You have to remember that everything in the scripture exists at different levels of understanding. So also the benedictions can be understood as purely spiritual benedictions from that level. So they operate both ways.
So further to what Mata just said, you know, about fruiting actions, you know, like you don't do it because you want some fruits. So how does that kind of, how do you kind of balance it off?
What becomes your, what other motive do you have?
Yeah, you know, like every time, like we have, I go to a Bhakti Viksha class, and every, when Ekadashi is coming, Mataji will send an email that if you fast, you'll get this benefit. This, and you're saying, I'm not fasting because I want some benefit, I'm fasting because it's the right thing to do, if you know what I mean.
Okay. So in the mode of ignorance, a person is working for material benefits, and they're very willing, and sometimes even enjoying, getting those material benefits at the cost of others, and in a sinful way. In fact, they're even enjoying the sense of being sinful. They're getting some pleasure out of doing something wrong. In the mode of passion, one is working for the fruits of enjoyment, except one tries to do it piously. And one tries to live a life where one is not exploitive, or one is moral and one is ethical. In the mode of goodness, one is thinking, I'm not going to work for any selfish anything in this world. I'm going to work for purification. I'm going to work for salvation. Now, it's still actually me-centered. I want to work for my liberation. I want to work for my spiritual purification. I want to work for my enlightenment. That's the mode of goodness. Now, transcendence is different than that. Pure goodness or transcendence is, I want the benefit of being the catalyst for the happiness of Krishna. So, just like...
Say that again.
I want to be the catalyst for the happiness of Krishna. That's the benefit that I want. So just like right before the questions and answers, so two of my friends came to visit me and they brought me a sweet ball. Why? What were they doing it for? They wanted me to be happy. And they wanted for them to... They didn't just want me to be happy in a general way. They wanted me to be happy with them. Right? Just like that's with people that we care about, we want them to be happy because of something that we've done or we've said or something that we are. We want to be the catalyst for the happiness of people that we love. And we then get happiness in their happiness. We all do this, right? You know, why does a man buy his wife jewelry? So she'll say, oh, thank you. You know, and he'd like his wife to be happy in general. It's not that he only wants her to be happy because of him. A man wants his wife to be happy in a general way, but he also would like her to be happy because of him. So that's how Krishna also feels. Krishna would like us to be happy because of him. He'd like us to say, oh, Krishna, it's, I feel so happy to see you. I feel so happy to serve you. I'm crying in ecstasy by just seeing you. And the devotee wants that for Krishna. The devotee wants that. That's the benefit we're looking for. So we're not just looking for our own purification and our own salvation. We're looking for a benefit that there's an exchange of love going on. So Srila Prabhupada taught us, you don't just destroy. You don't just say, okay, I'm doing things to enjoy the fruit. Let me now do things for nothing. Just because they should be done out of duty for purification. That's also material. Better do things so that, like I was talking about, Krishna's my company president. Do things so my company president will smile. Like Bhakti Siddhanta said, don't try to see God. Act in such a way that God will want to see you. So many years ago in America, there was some 14-year-old boy who had his own business, and he sent the government a check for $1,000. And he wrote a little note to help pay off the national debt. You know, so at that time we had President Clinton, and he called this boy. Maybe he also saw him personally, but at least he gave a personal phone call to him. So that's the benefit we're looking for. We're looking for the benefit that Krishna will say, I'm pleased with you. Now the way Jesus put it is, that our master says, well done, good and faithful servant. So that's the benefit we're looking for. We are looking for that. Prabhupada said, if you're not looking to be recognized by Krishna, your life is condemned. So that's what we want. And that should be the goal of our activities, to have an exchange of love with Krishna, to act in such a way that Krishna is pleased with us. That there's something I'm doing or being that is giving Krishna pleasure. Yes?
Mother, you're talking of the example of ladies giving you, someone giving you a sweet ball, but there's a person they give you the sweet ball, you smile, seeing the smile they see, oh okay, she's accepted it and my effort has been accepted. Now we obviously know that Krishna, we claim Krishna's a person, but you offer some flowers to the deity, but he was painted with a smile. So you know,
very good question.
How can you see the grace? How can you see if God is pleased?
Very good question. So let's say that there's someone in your life who has not dealt with you very nicely, who's offended you in some way or cheated you in some way, and you have basically cut yourself off from that person. I think most of us have people like this in our life, where there's certain people that we've distanced ourselves from them, and we've said, I'm not going to deal with this person. All right, now let's say that that person decided that they want to reestablish their relationship with you. So they contact you and say, you know, I would like to reestablish our relationship. Now, if this is a person you care about, if it's not just somebody, because some of the people that we distance ourselves from, we distance ourselves from them with regret.
Yeah.
It's somebody that we wish we could have a nice relationship with, we tried to have a nice relationship with, and they cheated us, and they mistreated us in such a way that we distance them out of regret. So, and there's a nice purport, I think, in the first canto or Prabhupada, I don't remember the exact words. He talks about Krishna like that he regretfully, I'm summarizing, he regretfully punishes people, etc. So if there's someone like that, so as soon as they write to you and they say, I want to reestablish the relationship, initially you're going to feel very happy. And your first reaction may be very warm. But you're also going to be watching to see whether or not the same problem still exists. Now, if you see that the same problem still exists, then what are you going to do? You're going to keep some distance. But you may give that person instructions. You may say, and you may give it directly, or you may even give it to a friend, depending on how troublesome the person is. You may say, okay, you know, I'm really happy that you want to reestablish a relationship, but this is what I need from you. If you want to do it, this is what I need from you. So with Krishna, one thing that's a little hard for us to understand is that the break in my relationship with Krishna is entirely my responsibility. It's not in a material relationship, there's usually a fault on both sides. In this situation, the responsibility is only mine. It's not Krishna's at all. And I've been acting in a way for a long time that Krishna has very strong reasons not to trust me. So if I'm going to do something that pleases him, I have to do it in a very formal way at first. You know, you just imagine if some guy cheated on his wife, and he says, you know, I want to cheat on his wife with 20 different women, he says, no, I want to come back. She's not going to just let him back into the living room. He may have to sit outside the step. You know, it may have to be very formal. And the injured party is the one who has to initiate a more intimate relationship. The person who cheated me and lied to me, they cannot initiate intimacy with me. They just can't. They don't have the right to do that. They lost the right to do that. I'm the one who has to say, okay, you can come back in. So the only way that, how do you know that that person's pleased? You have to know through a third party, or you have to know because you follow their instructions, and you're assuming if you follow their instructions that they're pleased. You're not going, you know, you may get some direct. It's kind of like you're sitting outside the doorstep. You make it sometimes. The person may open the door and talk to you and see how you respond. So I've noticed, you know, in the beginning, that Krishna often gives a lot of reciprocation to somebody, and then he says, okay, let's see, you know, this is what you have to do. And then we have to ask ourselves, do I still cheat Krishna? From the day I said, Krishna, okay, now I'm yours, now I want a relationship, have I never gone and flirted with Maya again? Can I go a whole day without flirting with Maya? I mean, So the guy says to his wife, I'm going to be faithful to you, and she looks out the window and he's flirting with somebody else. You know, it'll take some time. But I'm thinking about, several different people. I'm thinking about one person in particular that, you know, I kept saying, this is what you have to do, and she just wouldn't do it. And she would insist, you know, I want to come and see you. And finally, I had to say no. You can't, you know, first I'm giving you two things, so you do those two things, and then I'll see you. And she's just going to have to trust that if she does those things, I'll actually be happy because I'm the one who's telling her to do them. And I'm going to wait for a while and see if she actually makes some change before I'm going to let her back into my room and into my house and talk to her again, and that she can actually, you know, to let that person have the kind of exchange I had with these other people would probably take a few years. So, I mean, one of the reasons it's hard for us to take is because we don't have humility. You know, we think that all I should be able, you know, all I have to say is, I'm sorry, Krishna, here I am. You know, we really don't understand the depth of what we're doing wrong. We take it very lightly. Again, I'm sure in our material relationships, we have people who've cheated us and lied to us, and they take it lightly. Well, I said, I'm sorry. It's like, it needs a little more than that. I mean, I've had people like that who are just like, I'm sorry. You know, just you say you're sorry. You know, can you show me your... And then they'll say things like, I'm thinking about somebody else now, but someone who'll say, oh, Romila, I'm so sorry. But, you know, I mean, it wasn't really my fault. Or, yeah, I'm really sorry, but, you know, it wasn't a big deal. I mean, why are you making such a big deal out of it? So that's what we do with Krishna. And Krishna, I'm sorry, here I am, here's the flower, come smile at me. In fact, that's kind of even disrespectful considering the actual situation. He's got to be the one to initiate intimacy. That's one of the reasons Prabhupada said we're worshipping the deity like Lakshmi Narayan. We're worshipping the deity in a formal way. We cannot come to Krishna in an intimate way. He has to invite us. He has to trust us. You know, Shiva Ramaraj recently wrote this in his book about chanting. It's not so much whether we have faith in Krishna, it's whether he has faith in us. You know, our Krishna is actually very soft. Especially Krishna in Vrindavan. Original Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan, he doesn't even kill demons. He's very soft. So Maya Devi's protecting him. Lord Shiva and Balaram. So he may occasionally, open the door and give us some direct reciprocation. And I'm sure that most of us experience that sometimes. That sometimes we get some incredible reciprocation from Krishna. But as far as Krishna speaking to us directly and seeing Krishna face to face, which Prabhupada promised us that that would happen, that we would see Krishna face to face and he would speak to us directly. He's going to do that once we're not going to try to exploit him anymore. So that's... We're on a probation period where we have to have some trust that if this is his instructions and we follow those, that he's going to be pleased. And after we follow his instructions for a long enough time and we've proven ourselves, that then he'll trust us. Is that all right? All right. I think we can end here unless somebody has something urgent. Yes?
Can I talk about Krishna?
Yes, you can talk about him.
You said Krishna is soft, it's hard to satisfy his senses.
No, it's not hard to satisfy him at all. Krishna is very easy to satisfy. Patram pushpam pulam tvayam yomi bhakti grantiti. He's satisfied by a little water.
He says we have to satisfy him to get anything right. If we don't satisfy
him... But he's very easy to satisfy.
Nothing you'll get right until you satisfy him.
But he's very easy to satisfy. He's not difficult to satisfy.
And sometimes you don't know where you're going wrong. Go satisfy him fast to get any principle right.
Yes, sometimes it's hard.
And when we get rules, regulation is of religious principles. There. No peace.
It is hard sometimes.
Rules, regulations, over religious principles, all done. Perfect. If not, then he's saying no peace.
No, it's not like that. It's not like that.
What?
It's not like that. He's not that kind of a ruler. He says a little leaf or a little water.
No, I mean like...
No, you've got to do all the rules and regulations properly if you want to go to the heavenly planets.
Yeah.
Not if you want to satisfy Krishna. If you want to satisfy Krishna, he says a little leaf or a little water with love.
So if you want to lower planets, you don't...
If you want to follow the rules in the material world and you want to become a rich and powerful person and have an angel body, then there's a lot of rules and regulations that you have to follow, and you have to follow them perfectly. If you want to satisfy Krishna, he just needs a little leaf and a little water. Okay?
Yeah.
The difficulty is love.
Yeah.
Difficulty is it takes a while to, and all the rules and regulations that we have in bhakti are for the purpose of awakening that love. So thank you very much. All glories to Shiva.
Grace Mother Umela King.